welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. What makes things funny? That very question is tackled by humor researcher and adventurer Peter McGraw. He's the author of the book, The Humor Code. He asked everyone from comedian Louis C.K. to Palestinian villages about what it is that makes things truly funny. His scientific query led him to some answers of contentious questions like, who's funnier, men or women, Democrats or Republicans? Or why are Jews so funny? From putting on a clown costume in the jungles of Peru in order to find out if laughter truly is the best medicine, to going to the chief editor's office of the New Yorker magazine, McGraw treks the globe in search of laughter. Peter, welcome. It's fascinating. So let's start off with this. You started off as a stand-up comic. Why? Why a stand-up comic? And how did you do?
Well, yeah, I never had aspirations to become a stand-up comic. I was just living my sort of normal professorial life, and along comes a journalist and said, hey, let's take you out of the laboratory. Let's go to a stand-up comedy show on open mic night and have you critique the comedians. You know, use your theories, use your findings, and tell me why they're funny or not. And I think I was just having a really good day, and in a moment of hubris said, why don't I get on stage and tell some jokes? And as you might imagine, that didn't go very well.
It didn't go very well. Why?
Well, you know, so one of the things that I realized much later is that world is not one where people sort of bound on stage and make up some jokes on the fly. These are pre-written, these are pre-tested, and these are people who know a lot of the tricks of the trade. And so I probably put together some jokes in about 24 hours or so. My friends thought they were funny, but these were not my friends in the audience. These were wannabe comedians and you know, hipsters and kind of the folks you'll find at an open mic night. And as a result, I really missed the target.
So here's a question. Is something funny because it actually touches something within a person's personality and their culture? Or is there a joke that's funny to everyone? Or are jokes, just like religions, only meaningful to those who embrace that religion?
Mm. Well, so on the Humor Code project, we found out the answer to that question is yes and no. So there are some things that they're not universally funny, but they're close, as close as can be to universally funny. And that's slapstick. That's kind of physical forms of comedy. Okay. So comedy that doesn't need language, that is purely physical, purely visual. And in that way, that cuts across ages, it cuts across cultures, genders. I mean, there's some differences there, but like if you think about Super Bowl ads, for instance, Super Bowl ads want to be appealing to a broad audience of people, an international audience. You know, hundreds of millions of people are watching. And how is it that advertisers go about making people laugh? They use physical comedy. But after that, it starts to break down because now your personality, your culture, your belief system starts to have an effect on what you find funny and not.
So the Three Stooges had it right.
They had it right. I like to think of, so to me, the person who had it most right is Charlie Chaplin.
Okay.
So if you go back and watch an old Charlie Chaplin film, it's still very funny. And it's very funny because he draws very heavily on physical comedy, on slapstick. But he does even something else that's even more brilliant, is that he has found the kind of themes in life that still exist today. The guy trying to get the girl, dealing with the bully, and so on. And he was so expressive emotionally, just using his face and his body language, those sketches still work today. And I think they work largely cross-culturally as a result, because it's hitting on things that are as universal as you can find.
Now, when my kids were small, I would make up stupid jokes, and they would laugh hysterically. Like I would, you know, why did the monkey fall out of the tree?
Yeah, I know this joke.
Because he was dead.
That's right.
Okay.
Yes.
You know, and why did the chicken fall out of the tree? Because it was stapled to the monkey. And anything like that, you know, it would be because it was so absurd. They would actually find it funny. What's the scientific reason behind that?
Well, so it's interesting that you bring up this monkey joke, because that monkey joke you could trace back as the start to the theory that I've been testing. Okay. So I sort of stumbled on this question of what makes things funny about 6 years ago, and realized obviously how important it is, and sort of set aside all the research I was doing and to spend my time doing this. And one of the things that I found was this little cited paper in a obscure journal written by a linguist, this guy Tom Veach. And Tom's work was the best explanation of humor that I found. And I took that idea and started testing it and adding a lot of psychology to it and so on. But what got Veach started on this was the question, why did the monkey fall out of the tree? Because he was dead. And he said that he laughed for like an hour the first time he heard that joke, and he set about trying to understand why it's funny. Now, what we call that answer is the benign violation theory, is that we laugh at things that are wrong yet okay, things that threaten our identity, our belief structure, that seem sort of amiss, unsettling, that at the same time is safe, acceptable, or okay in any way, or as we say, benign violation.
Interesting. Now, is that the same thing as the elephant jokes?
Well, so these elephant jokes, yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of times these elephant jokes have that those elements of wrong yet okay. But of course, elephant jokes have taken on their a whole other structure.
I actually heard one that to this day, okay, I'm 59 years old, I don't even know why it was funny. It's like an elephant was in a bathtub and, you know, passed the soap, no soap radio. What does that mean? Did you ever hear that joke?
I haven't, no.
No, I mean, I have it in my elephant joke book. You heard it, John. My engineer heard it. And I don't know why it's funny.
Well, so the issue is that this is the amazing thing about comedy, is that the fact is that it's not funny to you is okay. It doesn't mean that there's something wrong with you. It also doesn't mean there's something wrong with the joke because someone else finds it funny, right? So if we laugh at the things that are wrong yet okay, it just depends on your individual perspective. Can you figure out, see what's wrong, what's okay? Is that because of how you were raised, your own personal experiences, your culture, so on and so forth? And so I think a lot of people don't find elephant jokes funny, and a lot of people don't find wordplay funny, but people who are, for instance, kind of nerdy, bookish, they care.
They do.
They do.
Okay. It's like New York Magazine, the New Yorker.
Yes.
I never found any of their jokes funny. Mm. Okay. And it's not that, and I think it just appeals to a certain set of people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's why I think your work is just so vitally important, because doing executive life coach, doing hypnosis, for 37 years, the one thing that is absolutely true, that as it says in the Bible, a merry heart does good as a medicine, mm-hmm. that there's something about laughter that actually changes one's perspective, and tragedy doesn't seem as tragic if you could laugh at it. Now, did you find that your research bore that out?
Indeed, yes. So one of the interesting things about this idea of humor and coping is that certainly comedy seems to be a good way to deal with the pain and stress and adversity of life. And my co-author and I, Joel Werner, we went to the Amazon with Patch Adams and 100 hospital clowns.
Did you really? Wow, okay.
Yeah, it was incredible. And we actually, they said, you can come with us, but you have to clown, which I had never done and Joel had never done. And so we like bought a bunch of absurd clothes and then like showed up one day in the Amazon to help with this service project. And we were there because we wanted to think hard about this question of, is laughter the best medicine? And there's a lot of good reasons to believe that's the case. So first of all, when you're laughing, you're typically in a positive emotional state. And the research is clear that positive emotions help buffer us from the stresses and strains of life. The next is that people who are funny, people who can laugh in the face of tragedy, they're the ones who people rally around when things get tough. And so social support is also very clearly a good way to help people deal with the stresses and strains of life. So if you can maintain a jovial attitude when things are bad, the people who are going to stay close to you. And then lastly, and I think this is the one that is really understudied and underappreciated, is that the act of making a joke, the act of laughing in the face of tragedy, can change the way you think about that tragedy.
But that's the whole concept of neuroplasticity, meaning that when you laugh, you actually change neural nets, the way your brain functions, and it does change the way you experience life. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's really incredible. So I'll tell you a New York story about this. So we actually came to New York to look at the New Yorker cartoons.
And you have to also tell me a joke after that. So tell me a New York story.
So we met with Todd Hanson. We took a little side trip from the offices of the New Yorker, and we met with Todd Hanson, who was the head writer at the time of The Onion when the 9/11 attacks happened. And if you remember that time period, that was sort of like a no-laugh zone. Like, you know, there was very little comedy happening, and, you know, the whole country was in mourning. About 2 weeks after the 9/11 attacks, The Onion, the satirical newspaper, published an edition that was dedicated to the 9/11 attacks. And they did something that was really smart, was instead of making fun of the victims, which often happens in these sort of too soon situations, they made fun of the terrorists. And it was very, very funny. People were greatly appreciative of this. And one of the things was that if you make fun of terrorists, and you can laugh at these terrorists at how foolish and stupid they were, how narrow-minded they were, how hateful they were, now you're not scared of them. And if you remove fear from that equation, now terrorism doesn't work, because terrorism operates on fear. And so The Onion, I thought, did something that not only just sort of ushered that it was okay to make jokes again, but they actually helped people cope with this very scary world that had just been created.
I find that fascinating. Do you remember any of those terrorist jokes?
Yeah, I do. So there was. So my favorite one had a picture of one of the terrorists there, and the headline was, because the Onion builds all of their stories off of headlines, and the headlines are typically the funniest part of the story. It said, "Hijackers awaken in surprise to find themselves in hell."
What I was going to say is probably not so great. But so let me ask this question. I do find, because, you know, I've been coaching people for 37 years, I do find that people who are comedians professionally, very often in their personal life, tend to lean to being somewhat depressed. What's the connection?
Yeah, this is an interesting debate in some ways, because with the recent loss of Robin Williams, this has been really highlighted. You know, this is a tragic loss to have someone who is.
I loved him. Yeah.
Oh, I mean, he's
amazing.
He's amazing. I mean, I think people too often throw around the term genius, but
he was
it
a
worked,
genius.
It worked with Robin,
right?
And by all accounts, like a delightful, kind man who had his demons, right, who was suffering somewhat silently in this way. And so I actually am hesitant to endorse that idea. So from a benign violation standpoint, if you need something wrong to make something funny, well, then people who have a dark side, who have demons, who have problems, have plenty of things that are potentially wrong that they can make okay and make jokes about. So they can, you know, make self-deprecating jokes about their problems and so on. But we have a tendency to believe that overcoming a dark past could be a pathway to comic success. But some of it is that the people who are really, really depressed and the people who really are struggling, it's very hard for them to make jokes.
Right. And that, by the way, is the difference between really acute depression and this floating anxiety depression, because one cannot make jokes, and they don't laugh at it, and it makes them feel worse.
Yes.
In fact, very depressed people do better in crises than they do in anything that's light and humorous, because in the midst of a crisis, they find an identity. In the lack of in humor, they find no identity because they're not funny. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let me ask this question: being Jewish, why are there so many, you know, comics? I mean, why is there a disproportional number of comics in this country that are Jewish?
Yeah. So, certainly, I think that it's not only a disproportionate amount that are Jewish, but also of other minority status. So, right. So African-American, now Muslim Americans, you're starting to see more and more of them entering comedy and so on. And here's what we came up with as an answer to that question in the Humor Code, is that if you're part of the majority, everything seems okay to you. It's when you're a member of a minority is that you can, and when you have one foot in the world of the majority and one foot in the world of the minority, W.B. Du Bois called this two-ness. So you have these two lives, is that you can see both the good and the bad. And to be able to see the things that are amiss, that are wrong, the violations in the world, is a great way to make comedy. And so some of it is just there's opportunities and you have mentors and so on, but some of it is that you can just see the absurdities of life, the ridiculous things. So if you think about like Chris Rock, for instance, Chris Rock has great crossover appeal. So white and black audiences love him. And part of that is that you have to look at Chris Rock's life. Chris grew up in the hood,
right?
But was bused to an all-white school. And so he was sort of too black for the school. But he was too much
white
for his neighborhood. And so he never fit in either of those places. And he could see what was wrong with both of those places at the same time. And it serves as a great fountain for his comedy.
But what I find with Chris Rock, and I like his stuff, is that when he's playing to a black audience, he does different comedy than when he's playing to a mixed audience.
Yeah, that is definitely true because... again, you know, like race is a thing that shapes our perceptions. And so what's wrong and what's okay differs depending on whether you're male or female, whether you're black or white, whether you're Jewish or not, whether you're young or old. And so in that way, a smart comedian, which, by the way, I wasn't my first time that I got on stage, tells jokes about, you know, that their audience – they have some intuitive sense, enough experience that they're going to tell the jokes that they believe are most likely to hit. Sometimes they change them in the same night, depending on like how intoxicated they are.
And how intoxicated they are.
So
let me ask, interestingly enough, often in hypnosis, when you throw in a curse, like let's say the person has a lot of guilt, and you put the suggestion that they say in their head, fuck guilt, they put a big smile on their face.
Oh, that's interesting.
Why is cursing very often creates more humor in certain cultures and not in others?
So this idea of kind of like blue humor comes up a lot. And a lot of comics sort of look down on it, right? So because it's sort of a cheap way to get a laugh. Is the belief, and that's why like someone like a Bill Cosby or a Seinfeld is so esteemed.
That's true, but I never Seinfeld. I saw his show, it sucked. The guy who followed him was funny.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, meaning I love the Seinfeld show. I saw every episode, but as a comedian, it didn't work for me.
Yeah. But it works for lots of people, though.
It did.
That's the thing.
It did. So he was a good stand-up comedy. So give me the difference between a Seinfeld and a Robin Williams.
Oh wow. So a Jerry Seinfeld character is considered like an observational comic. So he takes sort of the regular everyday things in the world and finds what's sort of peculiar or wrong about them and points them out. And it's one of those situations where you go, oh, yeah. You know, you've seen that 100 times before, but you've never thought about it in that kind of way. And in the humor code, what we do is talk about this as a particular strategy by which you could be funny. We actually call it the Seinfeld strategy, is taking a situation that's okay and pointing out what's wrong in it. And what makes that thing that's wrong is everybody can agree
right.
on that thing. And it's really wrong, but it's not that wrong. It can't be that wrong if you never noticed it before. Someone like Robin Williams is a really perplexing case study, because he really sort of bordering on the absurd. Like, you know, he's kind of misbehaving and he's shouting and he's doing things that are very close to clowning in a sense. But yet he's sort of this like really likable, genuine, enthusiastic kind of guy, which helps sort of make this kind of behavior okay in a sense, you know. You know, he had such range also that I think...
I mean, he was incredible, you know. Like, yeah. Jim Carrey has a range like that too. So let me ask this question. Why is clown phobia a significant phobia that some people have, especially kids?
Yeah, you know, I think... So I have to tell you that I had my share of doubts when we were headed to the Amazon. You know, I was like, we're going to spend over a week with 100 clowns. That sounds terrible.
That's the only thing you're worried about? God, I wouldn't go to the Amazon if you paid me. I'll go with clowns to the Four Seasons, not the damn Amazon.
Well, we had, I mean, by that time.
I'd be worrying about having diarrhea for 30 days.
By that time, we were sort of grizzled, you know, world travelers. We had been to Tanzania. We had been to the West Bank. We had been to Japan. We had been to Scandinavia. We had been all around the world. And so the Amazon's like, okay, next stop. You know, it wasn't that.
So tell me, I have to, because now you piqued my interest. The West Bank, you went to Gaza, you went to the Palestinian. Where did you go, and what did they find funny?
Well, so we didn't go to Gaza. You couldn't go to Gaza.
Right.
But we did go to the West Bank. So we flew into Tel Aviv and spent a couple days in Israel, and then we took a cab to one of the checkpoints and crossed over into Ramallah. And spent some time in Ramallah and some of the villages in the area. We actually went down to Hebron, which, if there was any time along our humor code travels that I thought this could go really badly, it was in Hebron. We went to the West Bank in search of humor where you least expect it. So, you know, there's a long history of comedy showing up in dark places, in POW camps, in concentration camps. And so we're like, let's go to a place that people won't expect to be funny, with the prediction that we will find hilarity there. And we met up with a satire team who had a television show on Palestinian national TV. And so we were there during Ramadan, excuse me. And we were there in Ramadan. And at the end of the day, everybody would pray, eat, and watch their television show while they ate. And what was interesting was it was a pretty heavy dose of satire. They were making fun of a lot of people, Palestinian and not. And lastly, I would say this, is that what was really striking about Palestinian sense of humor was that it was surprisingly Jewish in a sense, that there was a fairly heavy dose of self-deprecation that we would find, which stood in contrast to Israeli humor, which tended to be a little bit more aggressive.
Correct. Yes. And then, because most people don't realize that Israelis, though they're Jewish, they don't have the same humor as American Jews and Jews from all over, but yes.
Yeah, the idea, I think, is that if you make fun of, so if you make fun of yourself, it really steals the thunder from your opponent. And so the Palestinians would sort of do it as a way to disarm people in a sense, and to be more approachable and to be more likable in that way, and it's, you know, it's not seen as aggressive and so on.
Right.
And so
like taking off your shirt and saying, "See, no bombs, so relax. I can tell the joke." You know,
things like this. Yeah, right. I mean, you know, the Palestinians are really very funny people, although they're not the funniest Middle Easterners.
Who are the funniest people in the world? By culture.
I couldn't answer that. I could tell you who people think are the least funny.
Who's the least funny outside of the Scandinavians?
People believe the Germans are the least funny people in the world. And I think a lot of Germans might agree, but I don't actually believe that's the case.
I believe that sober Germans are the last of the drunk Germans are funny. But sober Germans and sober Scandinavians, no, not so much funny.
That's at least certainly not expressive, right? That's one of the keys.
Right, yeah. Right. You know, they don't like to be self-deprecating, and they don't like people picking on them.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So what are some of the lines you can't cross? Interesting. Jews, Catholics, Protestants, they all, you know, have some comic shtick about God, and they can kid around and fool around. But you don't see that a lot in Muslim countries, okay? Or do you? Meaning that's my assumption.
Yeah.
That somehow God you can't really play around with.
I don't know. Well, I would say this. I don't know for sure. My guess is that Muslims make jokes about their religion just like Jews, just like Catholics do.
I haven't seen it, but maybe you have.
Well, the issue is I think that anytime you get people together who are like-minded, and if you think about religion is both a blessing and a curse in a sense, right? So it's a wonderful way to bring people together and to guide people's behavior in ways that are largely positive and so on. But religion keeps us from having a lot of fun at times. And so so whenever you have those points of tension, you're going to find jokes. And so I think that my guess is that plenty of the Palestinians were making jokes about Ramadan throughout the day because, you know, Ramadan is this really wonderful religious
thing. Right. Can't eat during the day, you got to eat at night.
But it's also a point of tension, you know. And so wherever you find people coping with their difficulties, so in the Humor Research Lab, we call this humorous complaining. So instead of complaining, just expressing your dissatisfaction, you're expressing your dissatisfaction in a way that's humorous, that's funny, that makes you and other people laugh. That's probably a good thing. And my guess is that Muslims will do that just as much as any other.
Interesting.
Any other group.
And what was funny in Japan? What did you find that they liked?
Well, yeah, so we had
sushi jokes or what?
Well, you know, yeah, we actually headed to Japan because when we were telling people we were going on the Humor Code project, they would say to us, "Oh, you have to go to Japan because I don't understand their comedy at all. You have to explain this to me." And so we're like, "Okay, love to go to Japan. That'd be great." And one of the striking things about Japan is you know, you land, you're spending your day in Tokyo or Osaka, and there's very little laughter. There's very little jokes. And you start to think, well, maybe the Japanese really aren't that funny. But what you find out if you spend enough time there is that there's a very strong cultural norm about where it's appropriate and where it's not appropriate to express emotion. So it's not okay to express emotion in public, at work, in the at school. And so, for instance,
and funeral homes.
What's that?
Funeral homes, I'm sure.
And we actually went, there's a Society for Humor and Laughter Studies in Tokyo, and we went and met the director, and I made a joke, as I often will, and I started laughing at my own joke because I think I'm funny. We all think we're funny, you know, kind of thing.
You figured it might catch on.
You might, right. No. But this director says to me, in a very serious tone, he said, "This is a serious place. This is not a place to make jokes." And I couldn't help but find that statement hilarious.
Right.
Because I was like, this is the Society for Humor and Laughter Studies. Like, if we can't make jokes here. But later that night and subsequent nights, when you go out on the town, you made this quip about drunk Germans. Well, drunk Japanese and drunk Americans together can have a lot of fun, right? So out at the karaoke bars and the bars and so on, and around the dinner table, there are jokes being made. And the Japanese have a really wonderful sense of humor. And they really value comedy as a society.
So, well, that's why they like comic books so much.
Comic books, there's a huge theater system there, television shows. So we actually spent some time on the set of one of these comedy game shows, these comedy variety shows, which featured, you know, a lot of slapstick and a lot of physical forms of comedy and so on. And those things are tremendously popular.
What I always found interesting about Japanese TV and Japanese comedy is that in America shows, you know, you win cars, you win trips, you win a lot of money. All they give you trophies. You don't get anything, and for some reason you're going through gobs of shit just to at the end to win a trophy.
Just to win.
Yeah, right. So it's such a different cultural kind of thing. Is there such a thing as universal comedy, and where does comedy need to draw the line?
Yeah, so
like Andrew Dice Clay, is there any place for him in comedy, or is he just, you know, in fact, just so crude that he just attracts, you know, people who are just
depraved?
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to use a worse word, but yes.
Well,
I was going to say seriously fucked up, but okay, you know, we'll say depraved.
So I think that it depends. It depends on your perspective. So some comics believe that everything should be on the table. You should be able to make jokes about anything and everything. That's the role of comic in society. So Patch Adams described the clown. Oh, I didn't answer your question about why people are scared of clowns.
Yeah, I was curious about that. Why is there a clown phobia?
So, by the way, that's not universal. So in other cultures, clowns are beloved.
Oh, okay. So that's more of an American
culture. It's an American thing, and some of it is that the clown has been co-opted by the world of horror. And so it's been associated with these dark, scary things.
God, the clown that kills.
Yes,
got it.
Exactly. You know? And so that's the, I mean, you know, some of it is.
Well, maybe like, the circus, you know, the clown that gets too close and kind of gets overpowering with the kids.
Yeah. And some of it is like the clown really does break barriers, right? So they are supposed to be disruptive, right? So it's the clown and the stand-up comic, they actually have the same origins, which is the trickster. Like, so throughout history, there was the court jester, the trickster, the disruptive force, the comedic force that, as Patch Adams said, the jester is the only person who can tell the king he's an asshole.
Right.
And not have his head cut off for
exactly.
It. And the clown and the king wanted that, needed that as like a reality check. And so if you think about comics, some comics believe everything is on the table. The moment you start to censor yourself is to let the powers that be tell you what's okay and what's not okay.
Then it's not funny anymore.
Yeah. Now, other people believe that the comedy should just do good and should unite rather than divide. And then if you have that particular perspective, then the list of things that are not okay to make jokes about expands. Because then you divide an audience versus unite an audience. And so really it depends on what is your perspective about what is the role of comedy in your personal life, what is the role of comedy in society, to decide whether it's okay to be like Andrew Dice Clay or to be more like Bill Cosby.
Right. And I also find, you know, I've been to a bunch of funerals, Irish funerals, where they're just drinking and they're laughing and you know, they're just having a great old time, and you wouldn't think it was a funeral, as opposed to an Italian funeral where the grandmother's jumping into the casket. Yes. With the mother and everybody else. You know, Jewish funerals, you know, they bring the lawyers and accountants to make sure that nobody, you know, whoever dies, we got to split this up right. Yeah, is it simply just so culturally related that you got to get the culture to get the comedy? And does alcohol help humor?
So to answer your first question...
And pot.
To answer your first question is, yeah, if you want to try to find the universals, or you want to try to understand those differences, you have to understand the culture. You have to understand what is it that people value, what is it that people believe, Why, you know, what is the purpose of a funeral within that culture, to find out. Now, I like to think that there's always some jokes associated with a funeral. It's just how public they are or not, you know, because if you've in some way accepted this loss, if in some way you're being wistful, you're going to come up with the funny things that this person was associated with. Now, the question is, do you tell them to the whole group, like, you know, in Ireland, or do you whisper them to your sister as an American, right? You know? And with regard to the role that alcohol plays, very clearly, alcohol seems to facilitate an appreciation of things being funny. Marijuana, I think, also. And the reason is that at least for alcohol in small doses, you get this a little bit of a mood boost. But some of it is that alcohol, marijuana, and so on, they decrease the sort of threat of the world. They help lower anxiety and so on. Again, you know, not in
right. in not heavy in large doses, correct.
But in small doses. And so if the world seems a little less threatening to you, then it becomes more ripe to take the violations and have them be benign. And so the very little bit of research that's been done on alcohol finds that it enhances humor. Now, whether alcohol makes you more funny or not is a different question. And for the Humor Code, we actually ran an experiment here in New York City with a group of ad executives where we got them drunk and tried to figure out whether they became funnier as a result of their intoxication.
Well, they may have become more relaxed and looser and therefore able to kind of joke around about their wife and stuff like that, you know, which leads me to the question of, do people make fun of outdated systems? Like, why do people poke fun at raising kids and marriage so much? Is it because of what?
Well, yeah, and why do people make fun of mother-in-laws so much, right? Like, that's these are...
Because they're a pain in the ass.
Well, and I think...
Well, they can be.
Exactly. And in the same way, although people don't want to admit it, raising kids can be a pain in the ass. It can be also tremendously rewarding. Being married is not easy. So anytime you find these things that are that have some form of tension, that are difficult, you're going to find jokes about them. Because those are the, if you think about it, those are the ripest instances for comedy. No one makes jokes about how everything's perfect in their life.
Right.
They make jokes about how difficult things are in this particular day. You know, so a hot, humid, or super cold, snowy day is a much better day to make jokes about than that perfect 72 degrees and sunny kind of day. So if you understand, if you think about comedy as arising from these things that are wrong yet okay, then in the ways that marriages are wrong, or raising kids are wrong, or mother-in-laws are wrong, difficult, challenging, you're going to find jokes. Now, but you also have to be able to find a way to be playful about it.
Correct.
To do in a way that's not mean and that the other people would delight.
So how do you make a joke to your boss that you really want to get something across and use humor? And then it's a two-part question. And what kind of jokes can you tell in a cancer ward?
Okay. okay, so, you know, so joking with your boss is risky, right? I mean, that's one of the things about it. So it helps to really know your boss. And I think that the best jokes to make with a boss are jokes about your common enemy.
Okay, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah. So if you want to make jokes with your boss, you're like, where's the entity in the organization that you both have difficulty with? Whether it be HR, whether it be senior leadership, whether it be accounting. That's a great place to start.
That is excellent advice, Peter. Is that in your book?
No, that's just something.
Now you have to write a second book. Okay, so now hit me, cancer.
Well, you know, so I believe there is comedy in cancer wards, because at least to the degree that you find people who are actively dealing with, coping with the challenges of having cancer, you're going to find funny people. You're going to, and this is a little bit sad to admit, but the people who you're most likely to find a bit of levity are the people who have accepted their situation.
And then I agree with that. My wife died of breast cancer. We were together 30 years, and she was hysterical. Mm. You know, she would cut across the line. She says, "I'm dying." You know, the hell with you. You know, she wanted, when she died, 48 hours of Janis Joplin played and Jimi Hendrix, and she wanted a wild drunken party, and anyone who was sad was not invited. Uh-huh. So she, that's absolutely true. It's how you perceive it. Now, it is true that, and we brought this up before, that people who are depressed, really depressed, it actually hurts them even further.
Yeah, it's not, you know, the really depressed, the people who are really damaged and really struggling in life, they don't turn into comedians, you know, they're not. And so in that way, you need like a certain level of actual mental health to be funny, you know.
But do you also need a certain amount of suffering to be funny?
Well, so this is the question is, I mean, you know, everybody suffers in their own way. It's just the comedians stand on a stage with a microphone and talk about it. And so if comedy plays on the taboo, if you have to kind of act abnormally as Robin Williams did, or if you have to talk about your problems like Richard Pryor did, you may seem a lot more damaged than you actually are, because the people in the audience also struggle with alcoholism, also struggle with divorce and so on. And so, you know, there's the evidence is that, for instance, that comics don't live as long as other creative workers, but they don't live any more shortly than other entertainers, actors, yeah, and rock stars and so on. So I think it has a little bit more to do with the fame and being on the road that takes its toll, than having some sort of dark underbelly. Like, people often talk about artists in the same way, right? Like, so to create good music or to create good art, you need to have some real suffering.
Is there any truth to the fact that most comics, unlike other actors and actresses, so are literally paid less? Is there any connection there?
Well, yeah. So certainly, comedy is the kind of redheaded stepchild of the entertainment industry, and that really helped us for the Humor Code in the sense that it's a small community, but it's one that's like surprisingly accessible because these people aren't sort of too big for their britches,
right,
so to speak. And so it doesn't get treated in the same way as other art forms. Some of it is because there's plenty of people making fart and dick jokes to make people laugh. But then there are other people, as we said, are geniuses who are, you know, who spend an entire career not only delighting crowds, but getting people to think differently about the world. And that is good art.
Yeah. Who was it? Alan King, who was a great comic? Not Alan King. Who was the, who is that guy who never cursed? Oh, Klein. Robert Klein.
Oh, yes.
Robert
That's
Klein.
Right. Yes. You know. And you know, and Robert Klein makes makes the switch to other television, film, and so on. Right. But you know, you think about like the Richard Carlins of the world, and like those are folks who want to be subversive, but they also want to entertain. They want to try to get the audience thinking differently as a result of, you know, an hour long show. And so, you know, I have a lot of sympathy, empathy, appreciation for these folks, because it's hard work. You can't do your best of as a comedian. Like the Rolling Stones can play Sympathy for the Devil for 30 years and people appreciate it. Louis C.K. can't tell the same jokes that he told 2 years ago because people want something new. It's you have to constantly be working and innovating.
It's a question, who's funnier, men and women, men or women?
Well, I wish there was an easy answer for this. If I have to give you a quick answer, the answer is neither have an advantage over the other. That people think men are funnier than women, but that's mostly because there are more professional comedians who are men. And that would be like saying that that men are better doctors than women because there's more male doctors than female doctors. There's reasons that men go into comedy, but the research finds that men and women are more alike than different in their appreciation and production of humor.
So do you find that the best comedians are actually born funny, or that they actually learn to make themselves funny? Because I find, like, in my profession, you know, my nickname was Dr. G since I'm 18 months old. I always fix problems. So I'm kind of the inclination that your natural gift is what you come with, and then you just perfect it. But what did you find in your research?
Yeah, so that generally is true. So in the same way that professional athletes start off as better athletes, but then become elite through practice.
Right.
The same tends to happen with comedians. So people are drawn to being funny. They tell funny jokes in class. They're the class clown. They're a funny writer. And then they say, oh, I'm going to try to do this for a living. And then they spend 10 years getting good. Right? So the... You know, Hollywood would love to have like 22-year-old, good-looking, charismatic stand-up comedians who are selling out arenas, and then they could turn them into movie stars, but they don't exist. The 22-year-old comic may be a funny guy, maybe a funny gal, but is a pretty terrible stand-up. He or she needs 10 years to be out on the road on stage 4, 5, 6
to get the timing right, to get the body language right,
to become a good writer.
So I want to hear about this. After your book, after your experiment, you went back on stage. What changed, and what did you learn, and were you funnier the second time?
So Joel agreed to do the Humor Code Project only if at the end of our travels I would get back on stage to prove that we've learned something along the way. This time at the world's largest comedy festival, the Just for Laughs Festival in Montreal. And I reluctantly agreed to that. One of the things... So the short answer is, yes, I was funnier, but that wasn't a very high bar, right? I mean, I could only have...
You actually spoke. Is that... Yeah.
But I told stories from our travels, you know. So I, you know, we had amazing adventure, you know, going to 5 different continents and meeting all these colorful personalities and the challenges that we encountered along the way. And so I talked about those kinds of things. That was really good comedy fodder, much better than the kind of stuff I had chose the first time around.
Okay, meaning are taboo subjects more funny? Meaning years ago, when it was not more acceptable to be gay as it is now, at least in big cities, of course. Still in small towns, it's a little tough. But gay humor was around forever.
Right.
Okay, is there something about when something is more taboo, it becomes more funny?
Well, I think there's a sweet spot. So if you think about... If humor arises from things that are wrong yet okay, from benign violations, an attempt to be funny can fail in one of two ways. It can be too benign, it can be too boring, or it can be too much of a violation. It can be too offensive. And so the challenge is that getting a laugh is kind of a moving target. So you need some taboo, but not too much taboo. So for instance... jokes about a gay or lesbian lifestyle are different now than they used to be. So like a year ago, I rewatched some of Eddie Murphy's old stand-up comedy from the 80s, which was tremendously funny and tremendously popular. He does a series of jokes about homosexuality, and I was terribly offended by it.
Interesting.
It seemed now, by today's standards, bigoted.
Right.
And so, same topic, still a taboo, but that has changed. And as a result, so some things can become funnier with time, some things can become less funny with time. And so you're trying to find that sweet spot. And in many ways, it shows you how hard it is to be humorous.
So, Peter, is there such a thing as a funny robot?
Well, yeah, we looked at this issue. It's like there's these computer scientists and linguists who are trying to write these programs to let machines.
I don't think it's going to work because it's all body expression. It's all, you know, who you are and the human flaws. I don't know if that's going
to
really
work. It's very difficult to do. So the answer is that the stand-up comics and the sketch comics of the world, their jobs are safe for now. There's no machine coming their way.
How about political humor? Does that kind of let off steam?
Oh, well, this is like this is certainly something that's really popular, at least in the United States today. It was obviously popular when we were in the West Bank. The role that the comedy plays in satire in terms of criticizing people in power. There's a long history of this. So Lysistrata, which is the oldest known, at least Greek comedy, was basically a farce, you know, a satire about the Greeks' government role in the Peloponnesian War. And so that's not going anywhere, at least not in the United States, right? So anytime you have tension and a place that has free speech and has diversity of opinions, you're going to find people making jokes about their politicians.
Okay, excellent. Yes. Yeah. We won't make any jokes about our politicians, you know. Obama is not really funny, but he is a joke. But anyway, but since we're not going to do that, we will just forget that. Peter, your work is great, and thank you so much for coming down. I think we ran out of time. Yeah, we ran out of time. But leave the door open for me to have you again, okay?
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You were great. I want once again to truly thank Peter McGraw for coming onto our show. He was amazing. Pick up a copy of his book. You're going to love this, The Humor Code. Pick it up on Amazon. Visit his website at petermcgraw.org. I am Dr. Errol Gluck. I want you to remember, to every problem, there is a solution. I am your problem solver. Now, you want to do something that's really great? Check out our other episodes on gluckradio.com. You're going to find that you're going to be able to go through Twitter and see which friends need to listen to which episodes. Keep listening. Keep sending in your feedback. Till next time.